Welcome to Research at Texas A&M. The following podcast, What on Earth Are We Doing?, is from the Texas A&M Institute for Advanced Studies Eminent Scholar Lecture, presented by Dr. Peter S. Liss. Dr. Liss is a professorial fellow in the School of Environmental Sciences at the University of East Anglia in Norwich, England. As a 2012-2013 TIAS faculty fellow, Dr. Liss is collaborating with faculty researchers in Texas A&M's College of Geosciences.
Okay, so the talk is entitled, What on Earth Are We Doing? And that's just the catchy title. The real title is Lessons from the Past to Help Solve Future Environmental Problems. And you begin from that subtitle to really get the message of what I'm going to try and show you today. That all sorts of environmental problems have occurred in the past. Some of them we've dealt with rather effectively, others we've dealt with rather poorly. But whether we've dealt with them effectively or poorly, there are lessons we can learn from those experiences which should help us in our issues today, our environmental issues now. And particularly, I'll relate that to the climate warming which we're presently undergoing on the Earth and will continue if we keep pumping carbon dioxide into the atmosphere and other greenhouse gases. So through the talk, you'll see it's sort of peppered with quotations, which I've, in view of where we are, I've taken them almost entirely from famous Americans. So you'll be pleased to see. So the first slide should give you the first two. So they reinforce the message I'm trying to give you, that those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it, from George Santayana, and more subtly maybe from Adlai Stevenson, the trouble with Americans is they haven't read the minutes of the previous meeting. And you probably all see the truth of that, and I might say it's not just applicable to Americans either. So I think those two sayings tell you again that we have to learn from what's happened in the past. If we forget history, then we are condemned to repeat the faults of the mistakes of history. So, moving on, the talk has contents which are listed here. There are many examples from the past of environmental problems we've solved either well or badly, on some of them in between. So I've made a selection, because clearly in 45 minutes, so just about what we have, can't deal with everything. So I've picked three past problems and then the carbon dioxide issue as the fourth one. I picked them because they're important, or were important when they were before they were solved, and secondly, because they tend to be rather large scale, global. So there are a lot of others which are much more local, and I've not included those. So that's the rationale for what the contents are. So we'll deal with DDT and other pesticides, chlorofluorocarbon, CFCs, lead in gasoline, and then carbon dioxide and climate change. And then at the end, I'll try and draw some lessons from these examples and apply them to the carbon dioxide issue that we now face. So DDT, first of all. DDT, the chemical formula is there. This is what it looks like for those of you who have a chemical bent. It's a totally man-made compound which was used from Second World War onwards, for a period at least, to control insect pests on crops and other applications. And it worked fine to begin with. This is a picture of crop spraying from an aircraft. And you can see it's dispersed above the crop, but gets blown around by the wind to places where the crops aren't. So that may cause some other problems. But it was thought to be rather benign at the time it was used, as in this example. And just to show you two slides, which are a bit pixelated, I'm afraid, but I think you get the message when you see them, that DDT was sort of scattered around without much concern for any harmful effects. And the next two slides just show DDT being sprayed around on what looks like a beach with kids wandering around in the shower of it. This is another picture of two women, again on a beach, I think, who seem to be bathing in DDT. So I think in those days, I think people thought it was benign. And this spraying is to control mosquitoes, almost certainly. So But things sort of went wrong because it was discovered that although it would kill insects, it also had some very harmful effects because the insects, for one, got immune to it, and so it wasn't effective any longer, and other compounds were then used. Also, the insects got immune to it. It was also found that it had some very harmful effects because it didn't just kill the insects. The insects were eaten by other things, and so the DDT was spread quite widely through the food chains. And so these were all bad aspects which have been noted by the people, not so much people using it, people who are interested in wildlife. So in 1962, a lady called Rachel Carson wrote a book called Silent Spring, which I'm sure many of you have heard of, some of you may have read it, but it was about the bad effects of DDT, and she explained it all in some detail. A book was quite polemic, and it created a tremendous amount of interest and fuss at the time. And President Kennedy was president of USA at that time. He obviously heard the public concern about it and appointed a panel of experts to assess the evidence. The experts concluded that Rachel Carson was essentially right, and there were many harmful aspects of DDT. And so then steps were taken to control its use more thoroughly, and in the end, after about 10 years, it was outlawed it for use in the USA. That didn't mean it wasn't used in other countries, but in the USA it was not used. Now, to explain the title Silent Spring, which I think is a very clever title for this book, there's a quotation from the book here. I won't read it to you because you can read it for yourselves. I think it's quite viewable at the back. But the point is that in the end, because of the DDT getting into other organisms which birds ate, so the birds actually died and weren't seen in several places where the DDT had been used in large amount. So Silent Spring means not something to do with water. It's actually no birds birdsong was being heard in the spring. So that's a very clever title, in fact, because you need to explain the title, therefore people have to understand what the book's about. So we'll draw a lesson from that as we come towards the end, but clearly having someone, a strong personality, who wrote a very vigorous book on the subject helps to get the public interested and the public demanding something should be done about it. There's a rather nice picture I want to show you here of Rachel Carson on the left, and I show it not particularly, but I show it really for the fashionistas amongst you, for the beautiful collar on her costume. And this is a 1960s fashion item. This picture is, I call it Beauty and the Beast, and you can see why. The beast is obviously the bird on the right. Well, I don't know what it is. Someone could perhaps tell me later on. So that's a nice picture of Beauty and the Beast. And the next picture is also some beautiful animals. These are elderly penguins in Antarctica. And the point of showing this is that DDT was found about 4 years after Rachel Carson's book in penguins in Antarctica. So that means that DDT got all over the globe. And this, of course, reinforced the argument she was making that this was a substance we really shouldn't be using, and we should use other forms of insect control, some of them chemical, some of them managerial. So that's the DDT story. And we will draw some lessons from it, but you can see the sort of lessons that one can draw. One, the science has to be very strong in order to convince public and politicians that action should be taken. The second lesson maybe from this is that when you've got a very dynamic, a very forceful personality bringing it to public attention, then you'll get much more attention than if it's not having a champion of that sort. Okay, I want to move now to the chlorofluorocarbons, CFCs. These are compounds which were, again, used from pretty much the end of the Second World War onwards as propellants for aerosols aerosol spray cans. You see it in the slide. That was actually a fairly minor use for the chlorofluorocarbons. They were also used as blowing agents in foams and various as refrigerants. So various applications of it. This just shows you the formula. It's a very simple compound, a carbon atom with three chlorines and a fluorine atom. And this molecule, which did its job, if you like, extremely well. Aerosol spray cans worked extremely well. They were very, very useful. And furthermore, it was thought at the time that the chlorofluorocarbons were absolutely inert in the atmosphere, because clearly from an aerosol spray can, you're spraying the propellant, which is driving the whatever is in the can out into the environment, and if you're hairspray or whatever it is you're using it for. It's thought that these compounds, the CFCs, were totally inert. And in the lower atmosphere, that was true, because it was found that they spread all over the lower atmosphere. You could measure them in all parts of the globe. However, what was then found after some tens of years of their use, that in fact they weren't inert when they got up to the upper layers of the atmosphere, into the stratosphere. And this diagram here, which I now use this beautiful pointer to walk you through, so what they were doing is they were being released at ground level in the aerosol spray cans and other uses. They mixed in the lower atmosphere and rose into the ozone layer, which is about 15 kilometers above the Earth's surface. And the ozone is there because it protects us from UV radiation from the sun. And without the ozone layer there, we'd have much more UV radiation impinging on the Earth's surface, and this would cause skin cancer, and does cause skin cancer in certain light-skinned people. So what was happening was the CFCs were getting to stratosphere, they're breaking down to give chlorine atoms, which were reacting with the ozone and decreasing it. You see, that's the situation. You go from left-hand side of the diagram to the right. The amount of ozone is halved if you take these blobs to be indicative of the amounts there. So now, in that situation, much more UV radiation is getting through the layers of the atmosphere and impinging on the Earth's surface. So the chlorine destroys the ozone, depleted ozone, the more UV getting through, more UV, more skin cancer. This is a very simplified version of the chemistry. In fact, the reason why the ozone depletion was seen most in polar regions, in the Antarctic mainly, but also in the Arctic region, is because you also need ice, nuclei, ice particles in the stratosphere for these reactions to go effectively. So that was the story of the CFCs. And just to show you what effect they had just from some measurements. So the previous slide was really based on theory, and this slide is based on actual measurements made from the ground of the total column amount of ozone. And what you see is these are different years. So this is pre-major use of CFCs. So the ozone peaked at about 15 kilometers, and you see it from the blue line. If you then look at the time, this is in the 80s, then it's dropped down to where the green line is. So all this ozone has been lost from the stratosphere. And if you go to 2001, that's the red line. All, even more ozone has been lost. So, and this is from ground measurements. You can also see it from satellite. This is a satellite picture, and it shows this is what the ozone hole looks like, if you like. This is the low ozone in the stratosphere above Antarctica. Here's Antarctic continent here. And yeah, so what happened was there was the theory, if you like, was enunciated 10 years before the measurements could actually show that the ozone was being depleted. And as soon as those two things came together, i.e. the measurements, if you like, and the theory or the modeling came together, then action was taken. And this picture shows the annual production of these compounds as a function of time. And you'll see Beyond this point here, about 1990, production dropped off very rapidly. And the reason for that is because there was just let me do this slide first. This just shows what will happen in the future. Now we are controlling the use of CFCs. So just look at the bottom part of the diagram. This is Southern Hemisphere, 60 South to 90 South. This is up to the year 2000 when we started to control the CFCs about this time. And you'll see that the observations are the black line, just about see it. And the modeling results are just showing that you can explain what's happening. And you see the ozone dropping off. This is ozone here. See it dropping off onto that point. And this is the measurements there and after. And this is what the models predict will happen for the next 30 or 40 years. And you'll see by about 2040, 2050, we'll be back to an ozone level in the stratosphere, which is getting on to quite close to what it was before we started using CFCs or before they started to get to the stratospheric ozone. So that's a good news story. And I just want to show you the time sequence of this. It gives us an idea how long it takes for things to happen. Even when the science case is well proven. So late 1940s, major production of CFCs for aerosol use, etc., and these compounds were thought to be inert. Then in 1973, Jim Lovelock showed that CFCs were globally distributed, so that meant they weren't destroyed in the troposphere, in the lower levels of the atmosphere, and they got all over the globe. In 1974, Molina and Rowland showed it by theory that the CFCs could be destroying ozone in the stratosphere, but this was theory. There was limited regulation of the CFCs after that, but it wasn't until 85, sort of like 10 years later, that Joe Farman at British Antarctic Survey measured that ozone hole, and I showed you the slide of that just two or three slides back. And it was the combination of the theory here and the experimental measurements there, the field measurements, that convinced everyone, basically, that this is a serious issue which we had to address. And if we hadn't addressed it, then by 2030 or something, we would have very little ozone left in the stratosphere, and we'd all be suffering, too much UV radiation with the resultant skin cancer and no doubt other problems too. So within 2 years of this experimental proof of the ozone hole, there was an international agreement called the Montreal Protocol and subsequent agreements. And then it was at that point that the nations started to regulate the use of CFCs. And you saw that in a couple of slides back, how the manufacture went abruptly down. And by the year 2000, the ozone hole was starting to be repaired. By 2040, it should be largely repaired. So this gives you the time sequence. And two messages from here are that you have to get the theory, if you like, and the observations in alignment, both agreeing, and then you can see the science is really strong. And when that happens, then you can get international action at a rather rapid rate. And this is, if you like, a good example of where the international system has worked really well. So let's move on now to lead in gasoline. It's my third example, which I'll give you the message. This is a very bad example of how we responded to a pollutant we knew to be harmful. So this is a quotation of another famous American, Benjamin Franklin, who was ambassador to France in 1818. And you can read it. This mischievous effect from lead is at least 60 years old. And he knew about the effect of lead because he examined painters who use lead paints and also potters who use lead glazes. And he found they had certain illnesses which were easily attributable to the lead that they were inhaling and consuming from their activities. Also, funnily enough, soldiers too, because apparently soldiers in France at that time were not paid well enough, and so they sort of had a second job as painters and decorators to supplement their low salaries from the military. And he said, and you will observe with concern, how long a useful truth may be known and exist before it is generally received and practiced on. So we knew then that lead was harmful to us. It was known, actually, many thousands of years before that. The Romans knew it was harmful, and it's said that the demise of the Roman Empire might have been due because they stored their wine in lead-lined vessels. So we've known for a long time that lead wasn't good for you. It didn't stop us using it, apparently. And this story, what I'm telling you, is now based from the 1920s, when motor manufacturers wanted to have high-performance cars and had high compression ratio engines. The gasoline then in use was not very good because the engines started to knock it the gas pre-ignited in the cylinders. So they wanted to make an additive which would stop that happening. What you need to make it happen is you need some radicals. These are ethyl groups, which is what gives you the alcohol in wine and whatever. And they added these groups, which were the active part added to the gasoline, in the form of this compound, tetraethyl, four of them, lead. And it's this lead, of course, which we were concerned about. It was known even then that actually you could make additives just using this part of the molecule without the lead, and it would still perform the job. And that's actually what happens now, today. But we didn't. We decided to use tetraethyl lead, and this is the history of that. So 2nd century BC, people knew that it was lead poisoning around. 1892, first report of lead poisoning in children from paint. 1920s, lead tetraethyl added to gasoline. In 1965, a famous geochemist called Claire Patterson measured lead around in the environment and reported that exposure levels were 100 times greater than the natural background. And I want to show a slide or two of Patterson's work in just a moment. But if you like, he's the equivalent of Rachel Carson in the lead story, because he's the guy who really showed us that lead was all around us, and we were increasing the amount of lead very significantly. So 1970s, 5 years, if you like, later, tetraethyl lead phase out begins. Might add that it wasn't just the reports of lead in the environment which caused that. That was about the time when platinum catalysts were being added to cars to reduce emissions of other compounds, gases. It was found the platinum catalysts got poisoned from the lead in the lead tetraethyl. So there was another reason. And if you're cynical, you can say that there was more attention being paid to poisoning catalysts than there was to poisoning children. So 2013, now leaded gas is phased out almost completely in all countries. So it took a long time. It took 60 years or so for lead tetraethyl use to start and then to be removed. But all this time we knew it wasn't good for us. So I say this is not a good story. It's not a good news story at all. So just a few words about Claire Patterson. There's a picture of him here in American Samoa. That explains why he has the interesting native local skirt on, and he's there with his research assistant Dorothy Settle, who did many of the lead measurements. Patterson's a very famous guy. He has mountains named after him in Antarctica. He's a character in a book by Saul Bellow. And anyone who knew him knew he was a very interesting and extraordinary man who was very persistent and made certain the world heard about what he was doing by emitting so much lead into the environment. So that's a man who made things move. There's a picture now just to show you what happened when we started to stop using lead tetraethyl in gasoline. And this is some measurements by our own Bob Deuce and Wu and Boyle from MIT, but it shows the atmospheric measurements over a period of time from 1970 onwards going down, as you would expect, but this actually shows the amounts dissolved in seawater similarly dropping as we cleaned up our atmosphere from this lead pollution. Okay, so now there's three examples. You can see lessons sort of coming out from them, and I'll summarize those in the last slide, or pretty much the last slide of the talk. So now I want to rather rapidly go through the carbon dioxide and climate change issue, because clearly that's a significant, a very profound environmental issue which we have to face. And what can we learn from what we've heard from the other examples, which is applicable to carbon dioxide? So first, carbon dioxide picture. These slides I'm going to show are mainly from the latest IPCC, Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report, which came out end of last year. This is a report, consensus report, from many scientists, many hundreds of scientists, very heavily refereed, and done under the auspices of many governments. So this is a coherent consensus report. And so it's very hard to say this isn't the best knowledge we have on this issue. So this is the temperature record. Here's time along the bottom here from 1850 to 2000. You see the temperatures gradually going up. These are 10-year averages, decadal averages, and you see the same thing. There's some flattening in the curve up here for reasons we are now investigating, and I'm happy to discuss in the questions if you wish to talk more about that. This picture here just shows the whole globe, and it shows the temperature increase over 1901 to 2012, and you'll see the scale goes up to about 1.8 or something here, maybe 2, and so most places have temperature increases of about 0.7, 0.8 on the average. Interesting, there are two places which seem to have cooled. One is parts of the North Atlantic and also Texas. I don't know the reason for that, but maybe someone here could explain it. But you're very cool, obviously. Okay, so that's the temperature record. That warming has produced a sort of diminution in the area of the Arctic ice amount, and you'll see it here. This is 1980. This is 2003. You can see a great chunk of this is not there in the lower picture. So the rising temperatures has melted quite a significant amount of ice. And of course, it's thought that temperature rise is due to increase in atmospheric CO2 from the burning of fossil fuels. That shows that record. This is a well-known trend from 1958, from Charles Keeling's work, started at Scripps and now continuing all the way. And this shows the sawtooth as the terrestrial biosphere, the forests and other living matter in the Northern Hemisphere draws down CO2 in the spring and returns it in the autumn and winter. The red line is at Hawaii, and the black line is the South Pole, where there's much smaller wiggle because there's much less land in the Southern Hemisphere. But they both show the seasonal cycle to some degree. And they both show the rising trend. Interestingly, and more recently, of course, people have been looking at CO2 in the oceans. And this picture shows the CO2 rising. This data set is not as long as the one up here, the atmospheric one. This is the ocean one. It starts about 1990. You see the increase in surface CO2 in the surface oceans, and it goes up and down. And these are different sites, three different sites, North Atlantic and North Pacific, but it's generally increasing. And the pH, which is a measure of the acidity of the seawater, is concomitantly dropping down. And it's really interesting because this increase you see here, this drawdown, exactly mirror what you would expect from that increasing trend in the atmospheric CO2. So, and this is not a new message. I mean, this is another quote from Lyndon Johnson's special message to Congress in 1965. So that's getting on for 50 years ago. It says, this generation has altered the composition of the atmosphere on a global scale through a steady increase in carbon dioxide from the burning of fossil fuels. So we've known about this stuff for a long time. So the ocean is taking up carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, probably between 35 and 40%. And so that the oceans provide a great service to mankind, because if it wasn't in the oceans, it would be in the atmosphere, and it'd be even warmer than it is now. So, but of course, it has some effect in the seawater. So the effect, as I showed you, is to lower the pH of the seawater by taking up that CO2. These two pictures, the top line, bottom line, show some organisms grown in the laboratory. These are the beautiful calcium carbonate organisms, and they are the healthy ones here. These are the ones grown under a bit more than double the level of CO2, which we'll see this century easily if we keep going on burning fossil fuel at the present rates. And you'll see these shells now are much less well-defined, much more broken up, much more serrated. And so you can see in the lab that that has a real effect on the organisms that live in the oceans. This is a very hot and recent research area, and we're still trying to find out what the effect of the increased CO2 and the lower pH of the oceans is on different sorts of organisms. These are small plankton. Of course, it goes right up to coral reefs, which are also built from calcium carbonate. So this picture, I'm afraid, is hard to see, but there's a lot of it. So this is the attempt by the IPCC to do the attribution of the various properties of the world system, which have changed over the last century. I just look at this bottom panel here, which I hope you can see enough of. This shows the temperature increase in the land surface, the temperature increase in the land and ocean, and this is the amount of heat which has gone into the oceans. And the black line shows the records. This is the record of temperature over the land. It's the combined temperature record. So you see it's less steep when you take land and ocean together, because a lot of that heat has gone into the oceans. That shows up here as the increase in heat content in the oceans. And in order to try and explain, so if you try and explain that using a model, if you have a model which only has natural forcings, you get this mauve swatch line, and you can't explain the observations. If you include natural and man-made forcings of greenhouse gases, then you can see, you can explain the increase. So this is the attribution issue which climate scientists work on a lot. These are just some other things which will happen. So these are all models now. So beyond 2000, of course, we have not much beyond 2000 do we have data. So this is the data, this is the model, and so this is the predicted temperature increases over the rest of the century. So from 1 degree warming to something like 4 degrees warming. This is the extent of sea ice in the northern hemisphere, so it's Arctic, and see it's going down. And the different colors represent different scenarios for the use of fossil fuels for the rest of the century. So obviously this is a low fossil fuel usage, this is a high fossil fuel usage. And this is the pH of the oceans predicted, again, on those two scenarios of how fast we'll pump CO2 into the atmosphere. Okay, and that's what sea level will do on the same basis. So what can we do about these, about carbon dioxide? Well, there's a lot we can do. We can try to mitigate. To explain to those who are not well familiar with these terms, mitigation is like for the human body, it's like prevention of a disease or an illness happening to you. So this is what you'd like to do in terms of human health, and it's what we would like to do, I guess, in terms of human activities. So mitigation can be done in several ways. This picture is a color-coded map of the globe. It shows how much carbon dioxide is emitted per person. And you'll see, if you could see the numbers, which you probably can't, it varies by at least a factor of 15 between one country and another. And of course, we in North America and in Europe are some of the biggest, and Australia, some of the biggest emitters per person, but many other countries emit much less. So clearly, there is room for us to be more efficient in the way we use our fossil fuels, and so emit less per unit of energy produced. And actually, a lot of progress has been made in that direction. And most industrialized countries are now much more efficient in the way they use fossil fuels, i.e. they get the same amount of energy by burning less fuel, which is both good for the environment but good for the pocketbook as well. We can invest more in nuclear energy. I think you all know a lot about that. It's just to remind you that that does exist. There's some resistance, but I think as in the future, we're going to have more and more nuclear energy. We can try and harness wave power. This is a device that's trying to do that. We can have wind turbines, which you see quite a lot in the United States and in Europe. And we can capture solar energy by having panels on roofs. So there are several things we can do, and many I haven't shown there with those slides. They're just examples of some of the more obvious ones. Whatever happens, I think we're not going to be able to mitigate enough, so we'll have to do some adaptation as well. I like an adaptation to treatment or medication for a disease you've already got or an illness you've already got. So if you've got it, you better do something about it, and we will have to do something about adaptation. And so things like increased floods, which are predicted in a warmer world. This is a picture of a flood in the UK in 2004. If you've been watching the international news, we've had very big floods in the UK just in the last couple of weeks. So you can do things about these sort of floodings of communities by channelizing the rivers, trying to make certain that the water doesn't flow off as fast as it does. And one way of doing that is to have what are called green roofs. This is a picture of a building, rather unattractive building, I think, but it's got a very attractive roof to it where various plants are grown on the roof, which both insulate it, which is a good thing from a mitigation point of view, but also slow down the rate at which water pours off this roof and onto the ground and obviously ultimately into the rivers. So the sphagnum moss and other things soak up the water and it's released more gently into the water courses. So that's one sort of adaptation we can do. This is, and that's if you like good adaptation, because you can make your house look perhaps nicer than it would do otherwise. This is not a nice sort of adaptation. This is people's homes are close by the shoreline, which is eroding, and we think with sea level rise we'll get more of this and also more storminess. So these people are soon going to have to abandon their houses or build seawalls all around here to try and protect them from the sea. Whichever way, this is a costly business, and if they have to move completely, then of course that's probably not what they wish to do. So we can adapt, but it's a tricky business and generally very costly. This next slide is sort of a Photoshop attempt to show the River Thames in London, and it shows the House of Parliament under a significant amount of water. This, of course, is not the real scene, but it's an artist's impression of the scene, if you like. Some people in the UK think that it might be quite a good thing if our politicians got a good dosing with cold water, but I move rapidly on, as this is a science talk, not a politics one. But this won't happen, whatever, because the UK, for all its problems, is a pretty rich country, and we, of course, have a thing called the Thames Barrier, which controls the amount of saline water and fresh water which is in the Thames Basin. And this is an expensive thing. It's used quite a lot. It's being used more and more. And so these things here lower into the water and stop the flow. And so they stop the flooding, particularly from the seaward end. So we can cope with it in rich countries. In poor countries, of course, this is not really an option. The last thing to say is that there's something called geoengineering, which is really trying to engineer a large part or the whole of the planet. I liken that to major surgery. And of course, in major surgery, you may produce undesirable secondary effects, or you may kill the patient. So you have to be very careful with geoengineering. But this slide just shows some examples. Some people think you might inject aerosols, particles that is, into the stratosphere and reflect some of the solar energy coming in. This is what happens when volcanoes explode and push particles right up into the stratosphere. The globe does cool to some degree, so obviously the physics works right here. Whether it's a good idea to do this is a totally other thing. Others think it might be a good idea to add iron to the oceans to increase productivity and so draw down some carbon dioxide. All of these things, I think, are research issues on this diagram, but I think we cannot deploy them until we know a lot more about it, till we know whether the patient will actually survive or will the cure be worse than the treatment. So, what are the lessons learned? Well, I think we can just probably see them from what I've said, but let's run through. So first of all, science. The science is never going to be perfect. The Earth is too complex a thing to ever know everything about it. However, once the theory and the measurements come into coherence and they both agree, then you can be much more sure what's going on and you're much more safer ground to convince the public and politicians who are supposed to represent them that action should be taken. Good example of that, of course, is OZO. So for we scientists, we have to get the science as jolly well as good as we can get it so that we can make a convincing case, if such a case is to be made. Time. It takes time. We saw for the lead story that although we knew what we were doing, we actually took 50 years or so to actually get down to doing something about it. So time is very important. But once the science is strong enough, at least in the ozone case, we took good action. With lead, where the science was also open and shut case, it took us a very long time. If you can get animals and children, if they're affected by any of these things, like with lead and DDT, you'll get public attention much more effectively, and you can see why that is. It's not necessarily logical, but so, for instance, in the CO2 issue, it's not so obvious what the CO2 is doing. You can't see it with your eyes, for instance. You can't see animals, birds being killed, for instance, as you could with DDT. Next item, resistance to change. In all the things I've talked about, there has been a lot of resistance, and we're all subject to this. None of us are particularly keen on changing how we do things, what we do, what we use. But there is resistance to change, which will be changed if you know the case is strong enough and we allow it to have enough time. Communication. And DDT clearly benefited enormously from Rachel Carson being the sort of person she was, ability to write a very powerful book. Scientists in general are not very good at communicating their messages, so we have to get better at that, and we have to try and get other people to help us in that communication activity. Charismatic individuals, I've mentioned Rachel Carson several times and Claire Patterson here, obviously that helps. These, of course, were both scientists. What we perhaps need in the climate CO2 issue is charismatic political leaders to take a real leadership role in it. Can we dream of an American president in his second term taking on this as the issue that he wished to be known for? Maybe. Let's hope. Power of industry. Clearly, industry often gets blamed for all these problems in the environment. But of course, there is some truth in that, and industry has fought often against regulation. But of course, industry is also a major part of the solution, because if one thing is harmful and it can be replaced by something else which is not harmful, then industry has to take an important role in that. And finally, implied, I think, in all these problems are both the interaction between natural scientists and social scientists, because all of these things involve people, us, and our societies. And it's really only when these two get together we can actually get big movement forward to get things improved. And I just want to draw your attention to a new program called Future Earth, which is going to be the combination of all the current global change research programs into this thing called Future Earth. I haven't got time to talk about it now, but this is the website for anyone who wants to look into it a bit further. But Future Earth is both very interdisciplinary, i.e. it's taking all the global change programs under one umbrella. It'll also stress questions which are designed by users, by the public, by politicians. It won't just be set, the agenda won't just be set by scientists, which is generally what happens. It'll actually be set by scientists together with people who know what society needs to know about. So I'm almost done, but just one last quotation from Roosevelt, which is well known, was said in a rather different context, but we have the ability to solve these problems. We just have to use the knowledge we have and make the right moves to solve them. So the only thing we have to fear is fear itself, and that was in 1933, of course, talking about economic issues. And some thanks from me to TS, first of all, has supported my stay here at College Station, and John Junkins is the leader of that. The College of Sciences in the person of Dean Miller. The Departments of Oceanography with Piers Chapman and Debbie Thomas, and Atmospheric Sciences, Ping Yang. And then Alison Smith, who's the student I worked with here on a very interesting project, which you can find out about from the poster display, which is just off the lobby. And from Renny Zhang and Sherry Yvonne Lewis, who have allowed me to be parts of their research groups here. And just the last slide is some reading which I felt helpful in getting together this talk. And so this is your homework. Thank you very much.
This podcast has been brought to you by Texas A&M University's Division of Research. To learn more about the Texas A&M Institute for Advanced Study or listen to additional podcasts in this series, please visit tias.tamu.edu.